Can you hear me out there in TV land?
Yes.
Great to see you. Thanks for coming. Thanks to everybody here in Milwaukee. We've got an all-star panel on legal research and writing, some tips on how to cite, how to research. I think you're really going to love it. There's a very comprehensive outline on the... There's a very comprehensive outline on the website, so check that out if there are not enough copies or if you don't have them. Make sure to send in your CLE names to Paula, and she'll make sure that you're on the list out there in the outlying locations and of course, signing here. Next month, I'm going to lead the group discussion here. We've got Todd Koenig, Olivier Ryer, Kyle Jasinski, and Katie Doyle on this very complicated subject and what to do and what are some strategies to deal with these lender walkaways. When they get the stay lifted or if there's no bankruptcy involved, they go through foreclosure, they get all the way up to the sale, the debtors moved out because they're losing their house to foreclosure, and then the lender stops short and doesn't complete the process. And now the debtor remains on the hook for code violations and maybe real estate taxes and who knows what else. What are the things we can do, lawyers can do, bankruptcy judges can do to help with this problem? It's not just a problem for our clients, it's a problem for our communities. I really want this to be our next big thing that we tackle here. We've had some great programs and some great success with mortgage modification and our Lou Jones Club here. My next great project is these lender walkaways, and I need your help and I need your ideas. So this is going to be more than today. We're going to have a lot of lecturing and learning from these experts next month, and again the date is going to be October 9th. Next month, we're going to hopefully have more of a discussion and a lot of interaction and ideas from the audience. So please come on back. Come back in the video locations and come back here for a panel discussion on lender walkaways and what are some strategies to deal with them. We don't have anybody for November yet, so if you've got a topic you want to hear about or you want to present, we're happy to have you. We would welcome you to contact Todd Koenig. Or myself, or my law clerk, whomever you want to, just come on, volunteer, or say, hey, I would really like to hear about this, and we'll try to put together a speaker for that. In December, we have our annual ethics presentation by Jack Zaropoulos, and I'm sure he'll have some panelists with him, so you can get that ever-challenging ethics credit in December. We look forward to that. Ryan Blay is going to be our new coordinator for next year. So a shout out to Todd Koenig for putting the speakers together for the last 2 years, and now Ryan's going to take it over for next year. So thanks for stepping up and doing that. All right, without further ado, we have Barbara Fritchell, who you might not know. She is our librarian that's here in our courthouse upstairs, and Judge Shapiro's law clerk, Stephanie Webb, and my law clerk, Melissa Blair. And they're going to talk about legal research and citation forms. Take it away.
Okay. As the judge mentioned, my name's Barb Fritchell. I have both a JD from UW-Madison and my Master's in Library Science from University of Washington, Seattle. Now, there's a common misconception that legal research is about finding a statute or a case that is similar to your fact situation that answers the question you're researching, preferably in your client's favor. That's wrong. Legal research is about pain. You cannot avoid pain when you do legal research. The question you have is, do you prefer your pain at the beginning or your pain at the end? And the reason why I want to describe it as pain is because some of the databases we look at are set up to give you pain at the beginning or pain at the end. Now, the pain comes in terms of how much work you do either up front to get what we call in the library circles precision, or fewer number of results, but they're highly relevant. That requires you to do a lot of thinking. It requires a database that will allow you to deal with field searches or segment searches if you're a Lexis user, to be able to limit or filter results, and to precisely choose what database you want. Or you can be a paid at the end person, which means you get a lot of recall. And Google is a perfect example of a paying at the end database. If you try just any sort of search on Google, what's the first thing you see? Voila, you get a million results. Now, are you going to, if you're a paying at the end person, you're going to go through those. But part of the problem with being a paying at the end person, so I'm hoping to convince you to be a paying at the beginning, is researchers show that less than 5% of the people who use those types of databases will go past the third page of results. So if what you're doing on those types of databases is you're allowing the computer to determine what's relevant. And that, as my title of the paper is, it might get you good enough, but good enough may not always be good enough. So rule one of effective legal research is to know what you're looking for. You're trying to find what I just told you legal research was, binding mandatory authority on your issue. Statutes are binding on everybody. But of course, that means you have to find an unambiguous statute. Is there an unambiguous part of the bankruptcy code? Okay. So then we have to find case law that interprets those statutes. The binding authority for us is in the Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit. That's what you're looking for. Anything else is persuasive. Now, some courts are more persuasive than others, right? For example,
Second Circuit, maybe other
New York.
Southern District of New York, other lower courts in the Seventh Circuit.
Okay. So if you can find persuasive from the Second Circuit, Southern District of New York, because they deal with a lot of bankruptcy, perhaps other district courts within the Seventh Circuit, they might be considered by the judges here to be a little bit more persuasive than something from Guam or Louisiana. The problem you're going to have with the new databases of Westlaw Next, LexisAdvance, Google Scholar, is that they do not immediately allow you to limit your searches to Seventh Circuit. You either have to enter a search and apply a filter later. Westlaw, the old version, was very easy. You just typed in CTA7. You could go off and feel very happy about it. So knowing how the databases are set up will affect how you're going to apply that strategy. The next step is plan your strategy before you open the book or go online. Now, I'm going to date myself. How many here know that old game show, Name That Tune? Okay, I'm at least not the only one in the building. Name That Tune would have two contestants, and they would sit there and give a brief description of, like, this song was number one in 1960 during the summer. And then the contestants would say, I can name that tune in 7 notes. And the other contestant would say, I can name that tune in 5 notes. And they would see how low they could go and how many notes they would get in order to say, okay, that song is blank. When you plan your strategy, you're doing with Name That Tune on bankruptcy law. I'm assuming that everyone in this room is probably more familiar with the bankruptcy code than I am, so that if we were in a Name That Tune situation, you would always beat me, because you know more about bankruptcy law than I do. You specialize in it. I have to work with the rest of the judges on ERISA and tax and other things. But that's how you start your original analysis. Is what do I know about this area of law? If you think you can name that tune in 1 or 2 notes, go ahead, jump in that database, jump in the book, start looking for the section code or cases. If you're like me and you're not really confident, then I would recommend you start with a secondary resource. You can't search and know what a term of art is if you don't know the area of law. Back in the 80s, I took a continuing education class on bankruptcy law, where we had a bankruptcy judge from Chicago dealing with the question of whether milk was the product of a cow. Now, of course, this was during the height of the farm crisis, and product obviously had a specific meaning in bankruptcy law that if you're not familiar with it, you wouldn't understand the issue. And he goes, of course milk comes from a cow, but that's not the question. So if you're not familiar with the terms of art, looking at a treatise, and we do have two judges here who published treatises on bankruptcy law, slight plug. Then
that,
okay, Judge McGarity and Judge Kelly will help you to help figure that so you can come up with the synonyms. The other thing is, if you don't know a whole lot about area of law, then you're going to want to put in more synonyms as possible as you can think. Now, one reason why you need to worry about synonyms is, as Stephanie's going to show in one of her researches, sometimes our judges will cite to the bankruptcy code section. So if you typed in section 503 something, it might pull up the case. Other judges don't cite to the section, they just use the words to describe the section. So if you don't use both in your search, then you're going to be missing a good portion of the cases. So that's, again, pain. You got to take time to think of how does this judge or how might judges describe this. The problem with full-text searching is you don't know if it's a car, it's a motor vehicle, if it's an automobile, whatever. So think and plan before you get started. The third effective rule of legal research is to have someone else do it for you. And by this, I don't mean it rolls downhill in the firm. But if you can find a law review article, or if Collier's, or Ginsburg and Martin, if Norton has already dealt with the issue, you've got what is going to be the premier cases and the statute section right in front of you. You can save a lot of your time by looking at those, and then you can just update those resources to make sure they're still good. So don't reinvent the wheel all the time. You may have some sort of knowledge management function in your firm where you keep briefs that you've done, motions. If you've got a similar issue to a motion that you just filed 8 months ago, pull that out and use that as the starting basis of your research. So it doesn't have to be just a published book, but use the intelligence you have in your own firm as well. You want to strive for precision. So if you're going to use statutes, use annotated codes. Those are the ones that include the cases along with the statutes. And since you've all told me there's no unambiguous bankruptcy code sections, then you're going to have the cases interpreting those sections either in the database or the book. This is going to sound really silly, but read the case. The example I have in my outline is actually sort of a fun example because it wasn't an attorney who did it. It was a Sixth Circuit judge. And I just want you to know that all the examples I have in my handout and that I'll talk about today are not bankruptcy examples. I deliberately made that choice so that no firm would be embarrassed here. Parker v. Matthews was a habeas corpus case. And back in 1996, Congress passed a law called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act law, which changed habeas corpus law significantly. In Parker v. Matthews, which was just decided a few months ago, the Sixth Circuit had granted a petitioner's habeas corpus and used as a standard some language they had from one of their own cases back in 2000. Saying, this is how we decide habeas cases. The Supreme Court reversed, noting that the language from the case in 2000 was from a habeas petition filed before the effective date of the 1996 law. So they were applying the wrong standard. What we strongly suspect is that the law clerk working for the judge found a case. It language looked good, just cut and pasted it into the new opinion and did not read the case assumed 2000, it must be a post-1996 case. Justice Scalia wrote some very nice comments. So there's no reason not, I know it takes time, it's painful, you found a little bit of language you think is really good, but you need to read the whole case, make sure it's interpreting a section of the statute that's valid at the time you want, and to make sure that you're just not reading the segment and then in the next paragraph they say, not. Also, you can't rely on head notes. I know none of you do, but if you have interns, tell them not to. I used to work for the federal courts in Texas. We had two cases in the Southwestern Reporter where they left the word no out of the head note. So people were citing the case for the exact opposite of the holding because they took the language from the head note, not the opinion. Another painful step in legal research is you have to update your research. And you have to do it early, and you have to pretend you're in Chicago and do it often. Because things are going to change. The Moran's case that's in my handout was a Seventh Circuit case that came down in June. Between the filing of the appellate's brief and the oral argument, the main case they were relying on was reversed. They did not know that when they went into court for oral argument. Trust me, the judges have their law clerks check it the night before. They knew. They were also relying on a case from the year 2003 that had been vacated, so it no longer had precedential value, and apparently had never caught that as well. The amazing thing about the Moran's opinion was that Judge Easterbrook was on the panel and did not write the decision, so it came out as a kinder, gentler thing. If Judge Easterbrook had been on the panel, the attorney probably would have been looking at sanctions. The Seventh Circuit is getting extremely fed up with shoddy practices. And there have been several times where they have either asked people to write paragraphs on how to do research or have asked them to write a brief on why they shouldn't be sanctioned. I personally am waiting for them to tell them that they cannot charge their client or bill them for the legal research they did because it was so incompetent. And they haven't quite gotten that yet. The other thing is you cannot rely on free services to provide you with updates. In a few minutes, we're going to look at Google Scholar. I know if you're a Wisconsin attorney, you get Fastcase. Fastcase has this little citator service. It's called a cloud citator. It even comes in a graphical form where it can show you where all of the cases that discuss your case, and they'll do it by bubbles, and the more time in a year your case is discussed, the bigger the bubble. But none of those bubbles, nothing on Google Scholar is going to tell you how the court, how those opinions handled your case. It could be that they're all talking about Stern versus Marshall, they're talking about the circuit court opinion, but they're all saying, oh, wasn't it overruled? Wasn't that great? Blah, 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 blah. But there's nothing there to let you know that it was no longer good law. So you can start your research on Fastcase, you can start it on Google Scholar, you can start it on the website Stephanie's going to talk about in a few minutes, but you can't finish. You need to do either a Keysight or a Shepherdize to make sure your cases are good law. The last thing I want to mention about effective legal research is it's a common trap for people to think that what is online is more current than what's in print. That is only true in about 25%. It's usually true in cases. It is not always true in statutes, and it is most definitely not true in law reviews or treatises. If there's no guarantee a government website is going to be current. There was a big hoorah in Nevada over getting an issue on the ballot as a ballot initiative. They followed the steps on the Secretary of State's website, and then the got it kicked out of court because the Secretary of State hadn't updated their website for 6 months and the law had changed. So you just cannot assume online is going to be current. You have to make that separate step to check it yourself. I know it's painful, but it's got to be done. Now Stephanie is going to introduce our research problem, and we're going to start talking about some of the new databases out there for you to look at.
So we're going to be talking about four different databases that you can use: the court's website, Google Scholar, Lexis, and Westlaw. And to look at these four different methods, we chose the research topic that I'm sure is near and dear to all of your hearts: lien stripping in a no discharge 13. So I'm going to start by talking about the court's website. It's the wieb.uscourts.gov. For those of you who don't know, the IT department recently added a function where you can search the decisions of the four judges in the Eastern District. So you just go under judges and search decisions. It pulls up a total of 336 opinions, and they're listed by date, the most recent being at the top. And then you can choose from either to search from all the judges, or you can search by a particular judge if you're looking for one of the judges' decisions. So this is a pretty rudimentary search engine. It's not going to be like Lexis and Nexis, where you can use terms and connectors and all that stuff to get the precision that Barb was talking about. You're basically just searching for a term. You cannot use quotes, so if you put in quote, unquote, chapter 20, you're going to get an error message. You have to just put chapter 20. You cannot search for a phrase. Unfortunately, if you have two words when you're trying to search for a phrase, it's going to pull up every case that has either one of those words. So I plugged in a search for chapter 20. You end up narrowing the 336 cases down to 163. That's not all that helpful. So then I tried to search lien strip. Again, it's going to pull up the cases that that refer to lien or strip. But we do end up hitting on Judge Pepper's fair decision within the first seven results. However, Barb talked about the terms of art. Some of the judges use different words. When you search lien strip, it does not pull up Judge Shapiro's Linscott decision. So you have to kind of try some different searches on the court's website. The good news is it's free, so you can try as many searches as you want, and hopefully you're going to come up with something. When we talked about this, I said that a lot of times when I'm doing legal research, I like to search by code section. If you're familiar with the code and you know what code section you're looking for, and you know, with some degree of particularity, the issue that you're looking at, I find it helpful to search by code section because, like Barb said, some call it Chapter 20, some call it No Discharge 13, some call it Lien Strip. It's difficult to narrow down by terms of art when there's so many different terms of art used. So I did a search by 506D. In that case, then I did pull up Judge Shapiro's Linscott decision, but then I did not get Judge Pepper's decision. So you do, and I think Judge Kelly has a decision, and I don't think that came up in either of those. So you have to kind of try some different searches and see what you get. The other thing is I did check with the IT department. I don't see Craig or Derek in here. I'm not sure. You did used to be able to search, when you would search the keyword, it used to search the text of what's posted in the synopsis as well as the text of the PDF file. We're not sure when they did the upgrade if it is searching the PDF file anymore or not. So you may or may not be at the mercy of the law clerk or whoever posts the decision in the chambers as to what they decide to put in the synopsis. So again, just try to try a few different search terms. And then the only other comment I wanted to make on the WIEB website is I think all the chambers, when we post these, if something is later appealed, we try to put a note on there on appeal or vacated, something like that. But again, you still need to key cite it or shepherdize it on Lexis or Westlaw. You can't just rely on that as still being good law. You want to make sure you check that. Barb's going to talk about Google Scholar.
I attended a conference in July where one of our speakers was one of the six engineers who works for Google Scholar. Until May, they only had three people working on Google Scholar. That should give you an idea of what sort of resources are not being devoted to Google Scholar. He stated, quite frankly, their goal is that anyone will find something that will answer their question. So our little pro se folks who go to the self-help desk will find something on Google Scholar to answer their question. He quite frankly admitted he has no idea whether it will be the correct answer or the best answer, but they will find something. Now, I actually like using Google Scholar. It is one of the first things I go to if I'm looking for a law review or a journal article, because they include a lot of articles from outside the legal area that might relate to something we're dealing with. So if we're dealing with foreclosures, there might be something from a business journal dealing with it. It's also very good. I don't know if any of you deal with patents, but they very great patent thing. Cases, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not a place you want to end up in. Their recommendation was that you use the advanced search feature if you're an attorney, recognizing that the default search is for your pro se folks or anybody else who goes in. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know much about bankruptcy, so when they mentioned this thing, the first thing that caught my mind was Chapter 20, because a few months ago, I had done some research on Chapter 20, and when the person told me Chapter 20, it was like, hey, I'm no fool. I work on Ginsburg and Martin. It only goes up to Chapter 15. What are you talking about? And that's when they said, you combine a 13 and a 7, and then this sort of thing happens. It was like, okay. So, not knowing the code sections by heart, I decided to do a Chapter 20 and a lien strip. One thing that Google Scholar does is their default is and. So every word you add into your search query will limit the number of results. So when I say lien and strip, it's going to limit them. Westlaw, the default is or. So if you add lien or strip, lien strip, you're going to be expanding. So that's one thing to keep in mind, is figure out your database, what their default is. If you don't add anything, is it going to be and or? You can usually find out if you go to the FAQs or the help. Now, on Google Scholar, you have to go to legal documents, which is the second click for cases. You cannot immediately access the advanced research screen from the beginning screen. It will default to the articles. So you have to type in something, and then you can run that search, then you can go to the advanced. They do recognize phrase searching. You can do that automatically by quotation. You can also, once you get the original thing, you can either do an advanced search, or you'll notice on the left-hand side of the second page, they have filters where you can limit it by date or jurisdiction. So as you go through the handout, since I'm looking for binding mandatory authority, I will select on the courts and limit it to Supreme Court and Seventh Circuit. And when you limit it to the Seventh Circuit, it's going to pull up all of the district court cases as well. When I did the original search, which was Chapter 20, strip lien, I came up with 106 cases. Okay, that's a lot of pain for me to go through 106 cases. When I limit it to the Seventh Circuit, I get 8. Big difference. You'll see in, like down the fourth case, fair. Okay, I'm not seeing anything from the Seventh Circuit, so I don't see anything from the that's binding. I see a Supreme Court case. I look at it. I don't know how the computer pulled up this case. It doesn't have Chapter 20 in it. Quite frankly, they couldn't explain it to me. So it's not a perfect algorithm. But now I know there's no Supreme Court case dealing with Chapter 20, so I can throw it away. Then what's going to be my persuasive case? Since I'm practicing here, Eastern District of Wisconsin, I'm going to look at fear. When you pull up the case, you notice at the left-hand side, there's a how cited feature. This is going to be every case that has mentioned your case. And when you click on that, just the next page, you can see it's going to be cases. They may or may not be directly relevant. It's not going to tell you how they cite it. So again, pain. I can either sit and go through all of these cases, or I can go over to Westlaw and Lexis and shepherdize. The next page is Plessy versus Ferguson. Okay, that's not a bankruptcy case, but I want you to see that there is nothing here to indicate that Plessy is not good law. So that is a major problem with Google Scholar. You cannot stop with Google Scholar. Lastly, I thought, well, if I didn't know about this Chapter 20 and I was just listening to the words that Stephanie and Melissa were rattling off at me and not asking any further questions, I put 13, lien stripping, Chapter 7. You'll notice, instead of using Chapter 20, I now have over 2,000 cases. If I limit it down to the Seventh Circuit, I get 199 instead of 8. So there's a significant difference in how you plan your search and the results you're going to get. So you need to be flexible. You need to try a variety of different things to see what you can come up with. They will have all federal cases, so you don't need to worry about that. State cases only go back to 1923. I'm assuming for most bankruptcy issues that's probably close enough. It may not be good enough. I know sometimes with your property issues you might be dealing with cases from the 1880s. So again, you need to be aware of that limitation. The one thing that they wanted to stress out is that Google Scholar is not a natural language search thing. If you put in a sentence like, what is the effect of stripping a lien in a Chapter 20 case, the first priority word they're going to search for is the word what. So, don't do it. I don't care if you're used to doing that on Westlaw and Lexis. You can't use that technique on Google Scholar. Now, you're next.
I did a similar search on Lexis just to compare and contrast, and Stephanie did a similar search on Westlaw that she'll talk about next. One of the neat things I think about Lexis is you can add a bankruptcy tab to your homepage, and if you look at the first two pages of my outline, that's what it looks like. And it basically gathers a bunch of bankruptcy resources and has them all laid out so you can search directly. If you're researching a bankruptcy issue, you can search directly from that page. So to begin my search, I started with the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Appellate Courts, District and Bankruptcy Court cases. I did the search, Chapter 20 in quotes, within a paragraph of lien, within a paragraph of strip. And you'll note on this third page, anytime Lexis also added the feature, anytime you search anything from the bankruptcy tab, it also includes an option to search Colliers, which is nice because you can just click on that tab if you want to search both of those at the same time. That search resulted in only 36 hits, which was a lot less than Google Scholar's initial search. I then wanted to see if there were any Supreme Court, Seventh Circuit cases, or Eastern District of Wisconsin cases on the issue. My go-to search engine that I usually use is Westlaw, so I actually didn't know from here how to narrow it down by court. It wasn't very intuitive. So I found the live research chat section of Lexis, and I chatted with Catherine Kay, who was very happy to help, and she...
That's not a real...
Yeah, right. Dan Detter.
She suggested that I run the following focus search, and the way you do it is you put court, and then in parentheses you put what court that you want to narrow it down by. So I did court within Supreme or Seventh Circuit or Wisconsin, and if you look on the next page, that focus area is on the top left. And that actually narrowed it down to just one hit, which was the Fair case. So I think I probably got there more quickly than Google Scholar would have. I then use the Shepherd's function, which is not available on Google Scholar, and I think this will contrast a little bit from what Stephanie found on Westlaw. It showed the case was criticized one time, distinguished one time, and then followed six times. And then the last two pages, the history bar on Lexis is very useful. Is there one on Google Scholar? A history?
No.
Okay. So that link is always on the top right-hand side. then the last page is just the customer support phone numbers if you don't want to do the live chat and you have questions.
Now, the one thing that I want to mention at this point, and it's true for Westlaw as well, depending on what sort of contract you have in your firm, if you're getting billed per search and you don't have sort of a overall flat rate contract, you can call their reference attorneys or customer service attorneys and say, this is the issue I'm looking for. And they will develop a variety of search queries and then say, okay, this one looks like it's pulling back results. This is what's coming back. Then they will email it to you, and then you can cut and paste and run it in your computer on Westlaw or Lexis. And then that way you know you've got a query that's going to be bringing back relevant results. So, you know, the courts, we don't mind. We've got a flat rate contract. We can play around with it all we want. But if you're on a basis where you're having to pay a per search charge, that's something to keep in mind if you're not finding relevant stuff.
And on the last page of the Westlaw outline, there's the Westlaw representative number so that you can do exactly what Barb just said. Westlaw, you know, the search engine in theory is similar to Lexis. I started off using the All Feds database, which I think, you know, I have my saved databases that I've used prior, so I can still search using the database. The All Feds yielded 32 results when I used the same search algorithm that Melissa did on Westlaw. And then you use the locate function in Westlaw to narrow that down. So I narrowed it down using the locate function, quote unquote, no discharge, and narrowed it down to 18 out of 32. You can edit the locate term as many times as you want. I edited the locate term and used EDWIS to pull up some cases in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and there I get two. And I get fair. You can also use, I also have saved the Seventh Circuit database, so you can do the same sort of thing. It's the CTA 7 all. It's going to pull up all the cases in the Seventh Circuit, and there I get one result, and that is fair. Again, after you pull up any of the cases you're looking at, you need to make sure to shepherdize or keysight. Not only do you want to use this to just see if your case is good law, but it's also a really good place just to go and see what cases have cited it to get more cases to look at. So, yeah, I think I forget what you said yours were. I end up with two disagreed, one declined to follow, one declined to extend, and then positive cited and mentioned. So they break it down a little bit different, but it's the same in theory. And then similar to Lexis, there's the research trail to review your search history. Westlaw saves all your searches for 14 days, so you can go back and look at them. They're free to reaccess so long as you do that before 2 a.m. the next day. So if you're working on something one afternoon, have to leave and go to court, you can come back later. You don't want to research the same thing. You're going to get charged again by Westlaw. Go up into your research trail and access your research trail that way, and you can take off right where you left off from for free. And then again, there's the reference attorney number. Like Barb said, you can call them up and they will actually come up with a search query for you, so you don't have to you know, try as many different options as you would perhaps on the WIEB website.
Well, I'm not pushing a particular vendor, but you should be aware of the difference between Shepherd's and Keysight and why they had different numbers between theirs. Is that Shepherd's is run by a computer algorithm, and it won't pull up a case and say overruled or criticized or distinguished unless the sort of language is actually in the opinion. Keysight supplements the algorithm with their reference attorneys. So that's why they usually, on a consistent basis, will pull up more than Shepherd's. Because if the case, yeah, Brown versus the Board of Education does not explicitly say that Plessy versus Ferguson is overruled. But we all know that separate but equal is no longer good law. If you shepherdize it, it's not going to show up as overruled. If you keysight it, it will, because they've got that human factor in it. So you just need to be aware of how they do those.
The last thing we're going to talk about, it's the outline called Gentle Reminders for Writing and Researching in Court Filings. This is just a list of things that I came up with that I see consistently involving some issues, involving writing and researching, and then I circulated some of these ideas amongst the other judges and law clerks and also have some input there. So first, when Wisconsin Bankruptcy Court authority exists, it's best to cite that first instead of secondary sources or authority from other jurisdictions. And obviously a great free resource for that is the website that Stephanie addressed earlier for locating that sort of authority. Next, and this is important, remember the preferred pecking order of sources. The decisions of one bankruptcy judge in a district aren't binding on any judge in that same district. If a party appeals and a district court judge issues a decision, that decision is binding only on the bankruptcy judge who issued the underlying decision, not the other bankruptcy judges. If the Seventh Circuit issues a decision, that decision is binding upon all bankruptcy judges in all Seventh Circuit states. The U.S. Supreme Court, obviously, their decisions are binding on everyone. And then all of the other decisions from either bankruptcy appellate panels or district courts, bankruptcy courts, circuit courts in other jurisdictions, they will have persuasive, or they may have persuasive value, but they're not binding on a bankruptcy judge in this district. Next, when asking the court to follow a particular legal theory or rule, it's always best to actually cite it. Don't simply rely on the assertion, oh, there's case law out there, or it's in the rules. It saves us time when you actually give that to us. if you
heard that. Somebody say, I'm very good lawyer. I have always heard that. Cars out of trust, that's not dischargeable. I'm like, under what provision?
Yes, it's not uncommon. if you're citing a case that other courts have questioned as opposed to overruled, it's generally best to preemptively address the cases that question your case as opposed to letting the opposing party come back with that in a response brief, or even if they don't do that, for the court to then figure it out when doing its own research. Similarly, always, always, always shepherdize, key cite your cases often, as Barbara said, and just make sure that what you're coming into court with is good law as of the day that you're going into court. Next, if state law governs a question and there's either a state court decision, a statute, and a state administrative decision, some sort of state regulation, cite to that decision, be sure to cite to that for the bankruptcy court. If you do cite a source that isn't easily available online, which I guess it doesn't happen often, but it still happens, just go ahead and provide the court with a copy of that. It can be filed right on the docket as an exhibit to whatever you're filing, and that'll save the court time and save Barbara some time and us calling her, begging her to find a 1947 treatise or something like that. When citing a string of cases, don't just include a paragraph this long of bare bones cites. It's generally helpful to us to include a parenthetical after each cite as to why you're citing each decision. Remember the rules regarding citing unpublished opinions. And the rules, they changed fairly recently. So the second page of the outline has both the Wisconsin rule and the federal rule of appellate procedure that the Seventh Circuit has adopted. So if you need a refresher on those rules, that's all included in that article. Next, it's generally best to avoid engaging in selective quotation from a case. If the rest of the case doesn't support the one sentence that you pulled out that is really great for you, the other party will point that out or the court will figure it out. So if you're going to do that, it's best to include some explanation and preemptively address why you're relying on that for what you're relying on it for. Proofread your citations if you want the court to be able to find the case that you're citing. We do see a lot of times where there's, you know, transpose numbers or just the wrong site, and so and we try to just plug it into Lexis to read the case, and so it does take us some extra time if the sites aren't right. So it's helpful to us when they're actually right and when they're in Blue Book format as well. Last, don't hesitate to use our help desk if you have any questions when you're trying to file anything through the CMECF system. The phone number is there. They're very helpful and can walk you through it step by step. We also just introduced the live chat feature, and the website link is there. There's a green box on the left-hand side that says chat now, and that's also a useful tool. So I think that's it, and we can take any questions that anybody has.
Barb, you mentioned that ESI uses inherent researchers to go through it and make sure whether the case has been distinguished or unwest-sided. Have you ever heard of any errors in their, the way that they organize these in terms of maybe putting a case that was just merely distinguished as overturned or anything like that, or is it pretty reliable?
They tend to err on the side of caution. So what they will often do, if you pull it up, they might say, as noted, overruled as noted in this case. So they won't specifically say it's been overruled, but they'll say this case said it was overruled. So if it wasn't immediately apparent, that's how you'll see it on the sheet when you pull it out. I have not yet heard of any problems. We do know Shepherd's has had some problems. Sometimes they haven't picked up appellate history of a case, especially if it's been appealed under a different name. So if you've got the two parties in an adversary hearing, and then it's an in re on the appellate court. Shepherd's hasn't always made those connections.
Thank you very much. Please come back next month to talk about lender walkaways. We're going to have hopefully a really good discussion and come up with some ideas for how to deal with that. Thanks again to our panel. They were wonderful.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks.
Great. Loved your example. Perfect.